Hello, this is Paula Kaufman with the Herald and Review dated Thursday, February 5th, 2026. We'll start with an article on the front page headlined Weather, Winter Sludge Meets Soap. Car washes, outdoor chores make comeback as weather warms up. H&R staff. The recent break from the extreme low temperatures have attracted people to car washes in an attempt to wash away some of the winter grime. Temperatures are expected to slowly creep up during the next few days, providing even more reason to wash vehicles and do other outdoor tasks. According to the National Weather Service in Lincoln, Thursday's temperatures are expected to rise to 31 degrees, slightly below freezing. Friday's temps, however, should be 10 degrees warmer. Between the 1st of February and the end of the month, we really do see a big climb in what our normal temperatures should be, said meteorologist Nicole Albano. A gradual increase, with maybe a slight dip down on Saturday, is expected, Albano said. Early parts of next week, we're going to be on the other side of the pendulum. We're going to be above normal, she added. Despite the warmer temperatures, light snow showers could arrive on the weekend. It shouldn't amount to much, Albano said. Another system could bring rain by Tuesday, according to the meteorologists. We'll start to see more spring-like precipitation versus the snow and wintry mix, Albano said. This article is accompanied by two photographs in color attributed to Joseph Ressler Photos, Herald and Review. The first is captioned, Adrian Fowler washes the ice, salt, and winter sludge off of his vehicle after temperatures started to rise above freezing at the car wash on East William Street Road in Decatur on Tuesday, February 3rd. The second photo is captioned, as temperatures rise above freezing, Adrian Fowler washes the top of his vehicle to clear ice, salt, and sludge on Tuesday, February 3rd, at the car wash on East William Street Road in Decatur. Higher education, $24 million to help train factory workers. Industry leaders praise six academies planned for manufacturing sector. By Reese Dower, Medill, Illinois News Bureau, Chicago. As the U.S. sheds manufacturing jobs, Illinois is accepting applications for $24 million in grant funding to establish training facilities at community colleges aimed at bolstering the state's manufacturing labor pool. The funding is for six manufacturing training academies at downstate community colleges that will add to two existing academies that opened in 2024. The new grants will be awarded through a bidding process. The Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity announced that the latest application window opened earlier this month. Community colleges outside of Cook and the Collar counties can apply for grants ranging from $3 million to $6 million. It comes as the industry faces harsh headwinds from a wide range of factors, including those outside of Springfield's control. The Training Academy is an offshoot of the bipartisan budget and public infrastructure framework that became law during Pritzker's first year in office in 2019. The Illinois Manufacturers Association, a pro-business trade consortium, was instrumental in its launch. Today's manufacturing is far different than it looked 10, 20, 30 years ago, said Mark Densler, the president and CEO of IMA. For the states that are going to win on economic development, a large part of that is making sure we have a skilled workforce. State funding. The first two training academies were built at Heartland Community College outside Bloomington and Southwestern Illinois College in Belleville. The colleges now offer programs and certificates in a wide range of manufacturing processes and technologies, including robotics, welding, advanced automation, and renewable energy technology. The state also made awards to Richland Community College in Decatur and Kankakee Community College. Our skilled workforce is part of what makes Illinois a manufacturing powerhouse, Governor J.B. Pritzker said in a statement. This critical grant funding will empower more Illinoisans to pursue high-demand, well-paying jobs in our growing manufacturing sector. The state also awarded more than $17 million this month to fund pre-apprenticeship programs in the state's building and construction trades. While pre-apprenticeship training is distinct from the manufacturing academies, Pritzker promoted both programs as means to funnel candidates into in-demand jobs with high barriers to entry. Pre-apprenticeship programs are designed to prepare candidates to enter registered apprenticeship programs, ascension to which is highly competitive in the unionized building trades, said Jay Rowell, executive director at Hire 360, an awardee of the new grant funds. Other Pritzker administration policies have also sought to bolster manufacturing in Illinois. The 2021 Reimagining Energy and Vehicles in Illinois Act uses tax incentives to attract qualified renewable energy-related manufacturing companies to make capital investments in the state. The administration's announcement of the Training Academy expansion cited a growing list of manufacturers that are expanding operations in Illinois, some of which, like Cash Energy and Nano Nuclear, are REV Illinois program participants. Swimming upstream, the manufacturing sector as a whole continues to shrink across the U.S. Altogether, the U.S. lost 63,000 manufacturing jobs in 2025, according to data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Over that same period, Illinois lost 7,100 manufacturing jobs, a pace 2.5 times the national rate. Frank Manzo, an economist at the Illinois Economic Policy Institute, attributed this, in part, to increasing input costs from tariffs and federal cuts to infrastructure funding. The Illinois Economic Policy Institute is closely tied to several of the state's labor organizations. Manufacturing as a share of U.S. GDP has been on the decline for decades, as have the number of manufacturing jobs in Illinois. Average hourly earnings for manufacturing workers have not kept pace with those in professional and business services, according to BLS data, and the gap continues to widen. Manufacturing training programs have proven to develop skilled labor pools in the way the policy aims to, Manzo said. But he also argued, by far, the number one way to address any labor shortage is to raise pay and benefits to make the sector more attractive to new candidates who would otherwise not work in it. Unions have been hollowed out, Manzo said. As a result, job quality at these plants has been hollowed out. And that's one of the reasons why people don't want to work in manufacturing. Illinois unions have steadily declined over the last 30 years, and manufacturing unions have been especially decimated. Once a leader in the union movement, the Illinois manufacturing sector in 2024 was only 7% unionized, 1% higher than the national average, according to Manzo's think tank. In new sources of work like renewable energy and advanced manufacturing, where the Training Academy program is focused, union density is particularly low, according to Professor Robert Bruno, Director of Labor Education at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He also sits on the Economic Policy Institute's board. He added that labor provisions in Illinois' 2021 Climate and Equitable Jobs Act have made progress to address that challenge. The strongest institution for generating higher job quality is to work under a collective bargaining agreement, Bruno said. Many of the IMA's affiliated employers are unionized, but at the same time, their political efforts are sometimes opposed to strengthening organized labor, Bruno said. While not always in agreement on statewide issues, labor organizations and the IMA both support the Training Academy model. The IMA has a long history of working collaboratively with unions across Illinois on a number of vital issues, Densler said in response. Pat Devaney of the Illinois AFL-CIO said the state's union and the IMA's interests are sometimes in conflict, but they regularly work together productively. Both the unions and the manufacturers benefit from a skilled workforce, he said. But jobs must be unionized to be a pathway to the middle class. Course curriculum. Labor boosters said they were disappointed that nothing in the law or grant agreements requires the community colleges receiving grant funds to teach about unionization. Heartland Community College, which was awarded nearly $7.5 million in 2021, said the only coursework related to labor organizing or workers' rights in its state-backed manufacturing programs is a 10-hour OSHA construction safety course. Paul Carson, Dean of Business, Technology, and Human Services at Kankakee Community College, which received $12 million in 2024, according to the Department of Commerce and Economic Community Grant Tracker, said their curriculum does not cover workers' rights or labor organizing. We do not avoid these topics if brought up in classroom settings, Carlson said. They are just not typical of our stakeholders' needs or students' interest as they are beginning their lifelong learning and choosing whatever field of endeavor. Officials at Southwestern Illinois and Richland Community College did not respond to multiple requests for comment about their grant-funded workforce development curricula. Reese Dower is a graduate student in journalism with Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, Media, and Integrated Marketing Communications, and is a fellow in its Medill, Illinois News Bureau, working in partnership with Capital News Illinois. Capital News Illinois is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news service that distributes state government coverage to hundreds of news outlets statewide. It is funded primarily by the Illinois Press Foundation and the Robert R. McCormick Foundation. Minnesota, Administration to Withdraw 700 Agents, by Maria Tsitskova and Jonathan Allen, Reuters News Agency, Fort Snelling, Minnesota. The Trump administration will immediately withdraw about 700 federal immigration enforcement agents from Minnesota, though about 2,000 agents will remain on the ground, White House Border Czar Tom Homan announced Wednesday. In an unprecedented surge, U.S. President Donald Trump deployed thousands of armed immigration enforcement agents in and around Minneapolis this year, resulting in angry and sometimes violent confrontations with residents and street protests across the nation. Homan said the deportation campaign was in the interest of public safety and that he was partially drawing down the deployment because of unprecedented cooperation from Minnesota's elected sheriffs who run county jails. He didn't give more details. Grappling with one of the thorniest political crises of his tenure, Trump sent Homan to Minnesota in late January with a mission to temper the outrage seen in Minneapolis's streets, which intensified after immigration agents twice shot and killed U.S. citizens. The surge has been opposed and denounced since its earliest days in January by Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and other Democrats, who demanded the withdrawal of a federal deployment that was 20 times the normal number working on immigration enforcement in the state, outnumbering local police forces. Let me be clear, President Trump fully intends to achieve mass deportations during this administration, and immigration enforcement actions will continue every day throughout this country, Homan said at a news conference. The president's aggressive deportation efforts, part of a nationwide campaign, triggered protests, drawn criticism even from some of his fellow Republicans, and stern rebukes from some federal judges asked to rule on the legality of migrants' detentions, who say their orders are being defied. Killings of Good Pretty. The reduction announced Wednesday still leaves in place an extraordinary number of immigration agents deployed, a figure Trump officials called unprecedented only a few weeks ago. In early January, the Trump administration sent in about 2,000 federal agents to Minnesota. It was described by Todd Lyons, acting director of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, as the largest immigration operation ever on January 6th, a day before an ICE agent shot and killed Renee Good in her car. As January continued, hundreds of more agents were deployed. Homan said his goal was to return to the usual force of about 150 federal immigration agents in the state, but did not say when he thought that would be possible. Trump and his senior officials claim many migrants must be deported, blaming them, often in sweeping terms, for financial fraud and violent crimes. Minnesota, which is governed by Democrats, sued the Trump administration over the surge, which sparked weeks of protests that only intensified after federal immigration agents in Minneapolis killed Good and Alex Pretty, both U.S. citizens. Homan wants more jails in Minnesota to allow immigration agents to transfer custody of detained migrants. Some already do, though only 7 sheriffs out of Minnesota's 87 counties have signed formal cooperation agreements with ICE. Others, including the main jail in Minneapolis, run by the Hennepin County Sheriff, do not cooperate. Minneapolis and some other cities prohibit their employees, including police, from asking people about their citizenship or cooperating with federal immigration enforcement, saying it threatens public safety if migrants who are victims of or witnesses to crime are afraid to come forward. Homan, speaking at a federal field office outside Minneapolis, said he recently had useful conversations with Walz and Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey, among other elected Democrats. Homan, a former ICE agent, also accused protesters of impeding immigration agents, whom he lauded as patriots. Outside the federal building where Homan spoke, more than a dozen protesters railed against ICE in temperatures well below freezing. Dwayne Olberding, a 70-year-old psychotherapist from Kansas City, said he was happy to hear of any reduction at all. "These 700 people, I'm glad that Minnesotan people were able to get rid of them," he said. "But I'm guessing where they're going next is Kansas City, which is my home, which I don't like." Asked if he thought Operation Metro's surge had been a success, Homan replied that he thought it improved public safety. "Was it a perfect operation?" "No," Homan said. Cops. Men exchange gunfire, jailed. By Tony Reed. Decatur. Accused attempted murderer Anthony J. Dickey Jr. is now being held in the Macon County Jail, which also houses the wounded victim accused of pulling his own gun and shooting back. Dickey, 28, was found and arrested January 30th and was arraigned Monday in Macon County Circuit Court on charges he tried to shoot Marcelo A. Montiel Jr. to death on the evening of October 19th. He was denied pretrial release. Dickey also faces a charge of aggravated battery involving firing a gun and further counts accusing him of possessing a firearm as a repeat felony offender, being a felon in possession of a gun and the aggravated unlawful possession of a firearm. A check of his record shows he had 2 previous convictions for aggravated robbery in 2016 and 2021, and was sentenced to terms of 10 and 5 years in prison. Montiel, 25, had been arrested the evening of the shooting after police questioned him in Decatur Memorial Hospital. He has since been denied pretrial release after pleading not guilty to the aggravated unlawful possession of a gun and being a felon in possession of a gun. He had suffered through and through gunshot wounds to his left hip and buttocks, according to a sworn affidavit filed by the Decatur Police Department. The affidavit said an exchange of gunfire took place when Montiel was confronted by Dickey outside the apartment of Montiel's girlfriend in the 1400 block of East Wellington Way. Montiel is quoted as telling police that Dickey walked up to him, said, "Remember me?" and then pulled a handgun out of a bag he was carrying. Marcello said he, Marcello, then also produced a handgun, which was located in the pocket of the hooded sweatshirt he was wearing at the time, said Officer Jacob Thronberg, who signed the affidavit. Marcello said Anthony began to shoot at him, at which time Marcello returned fire. Marcello said he ran westbound and Anthony ran northbound after they began shooting at each other. Montiel, bleeding from his wounds, was described as charging into his girlfriend's home and asking her to take him to the hospital. The 24-year-old woman, who told police she had earlier heard the gunfire, is quoted as refusing to drive because she was scared she might get hurt if she went outside. She then tossed her car keys at her wounded boyfriend, who ended up driving himself to the emergency room. Thronberg says police recovered 8 spent shell casings from the shooting scene, 4 each of different brands of 9mm ammunition, and found Montiel's gun at the bottom of a laundry basket topped by a blood-stained pillow in his girlfriend's bedroom. No motive was listed for the shooting, but Montiel is quoted as telling police trouble started before the shooting when he drove to a nearby convenience store to pick up a packet of chips. He saw Dickey inside a vehicle with Dickey's girlfriend and children that looked to be aged around 7 and 1. Thronberg said police pulled surveillance video, which showed Dickey staring through the shop window at Montiel. Dickey is then described as driving out of the parking lot and was waiting for Montiel when he arrived back at his girlfriend's home. Centennial meets political pushback by Terry Tang, Associated Press. For academics, historians, and activists, the past year has been tumultuous in advocating for the teaching of Black history in the United States. Despite last year proclaiming February as National Black History Month, President Donald Trump started his second term by claiming some African American history lessons are meant to indoctrinate people into hating the country. The administration has dismantled Black history at national parks, most recently removing an exhibit on slavery in Philadelphia last month. Black history advocates see these acts and their chilling effect as scary and unprecedented. States and cities are nervous about retribution from the White House, said DeRay McKesson, a longtime activist and executive director of Campaign Zero, an organization focused on police reform. So even the good people are just quieter now. In the 100th year since the nation's earliest observances of Black History Month, which began when scholar Carter G. Woodson pioneered the first Negro History Week, celebrations will go on. The current political climate has energized civil rights organizations, artists, and academics to engage young people on a full telling of America's story. There are hundreds of lectures, teach-ins, and even new books, from nonfiction to a graphic novel, to mark the milestone. This is why we are working with more than 150 teachers around the country on a Black History Month curriculum to just ensure that young people continue to learn about Black history in a way that is intentional and thoughtful, McKesson said about a campaign his organization has launched with the Afro Charities Organization and leading Black scholars to expand access to educational materials. About 3 years ago, Angelique Roche, a journalist and adjunct professor at Xavier University of Louisiana, accepted a once-in-a-lifetime invitation to be the writer for a graphic novel retelling of the story of Opal Lee, grandmother of Juneteenth. Lee, who will also turn 100 this year, is largely credited for getting federal recognition of the June 19th holiday commemorating the day when enslaved people in Texas learned they were emancipated. Under Trump, however, Juneteenth is no longer a free admission day at national parks. Juneteenth helped usher in the first generation of Black Americans who, like Woodson, were born free. First Freedom, the story of Opal Lee and Juneteenth, the graphic novel, comes out February 10th. It is the culmination of Roche's assiduous archival research, phone chats, and visits to Texas to see Lee and her granddaughter, Dionne Sims. There's nothing indoctrinating about facts that are based on primary sources that are highly researched, said Roche, who hopes the book makes it into libraries and classrooms. At the end of the day, what this story should actually tell people is that we're far more alike than we are different. When Trump's anti-DEI executive orders were issued last year, Jarvis Givens, a professor of African and African American studies at Harvard, was thousands of miles away teaching in London, where Black History Month is celebrated in October. He had already been contemplating writing a book for the centennial. Watching Trump's attack cemented the idea, Givens said. I wanted to kind of devote my time while on leave to writing a book that would honor the legacy that gives us Black History Month, Givens said. The result is I'll Make Me a World, the 100-year journey of Black History Month, a book with four in-depth essays that comes out Tuesday. The title is a line from the 1920s poem The Creation by James Weldon Johnson, whose most famous poem, Lift Every Voice and Sing, is known as the Black National Anthem. Givens examines important themes in Black history and clarifies misconceptions around them. The book and the research Givens dug up will tie into a Living History campaign with Campaign Zero and Afro Charities, McKesson said. The goal is to teach what Woodson believed, that younger generations can become historians who can discern fact from fiction. When I grew up, the preservation of history was a historian's job, McKesson said. Born in 1875 to formerly enslaved parents, Woodson was among the first generation of Black Americans not assigned to bondage at birth. He grew up believing that education was a way to self-empowerment, said Robert Trent Vincent, director of the Carter G. Woodson Institute at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia. The second Black man to earn a doctorate at Harvard University, W.E.B. Du Bois was the first, Woodson was disillusioned by how Black history was dismissed. He saw that the memories and culture of less educated Black people were no less valuable, Vincent said. When Woodson established Negro History Week in 1926, he was in an era when popular stereotypes like blackface and minstrelsy were filling in for actual knowledge of the Black experience, according to Vincent. This sparked the creation of Black history clubs, and Woodson began inserting historical lessons on the sly in publications like the Journal of Negro History and the Negro History Bulletin. In 1976, for the week's 50th anniversary, President Gerald Ford issued a message recognizing it as an entire month. There was pushback then over the gains the civil rights movement had made, Givens said. As for today, backlash over Black and African American studies, Vincent believes Woodson would not be surprised, but he would see it as a sign you're on the right track. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half of the Herald and Review, dated Thursday, February 5th, 2026. Please stay tuned.